Long introductions are forgotten and fruitless anyway. There's your mic if you want to clip it to you or whatever you want. So I'm just going to say that Leon Wieseltier is the literary editor of The New Republic and the author of Kaddish, and an extraordinarily learned, eloquent, and also warm friend. So it's my pleasure to have him here, and it's all yours.
Thank you. Learned and tired, I have to add. David asked me to come and speak to you about something that was on my mind, and you could call it a theological problem, but as you'll see by the time I'm done with my thoughts, it's nothing that necessarily highfalutin. And it has to do with certain difficulties that I have, or with a certain, almost a kind of dead end that I arrive at when I think about the possibilities in the Jewish tradition for our conception of God. So I'm going to be speaking about that subject. And maybe to start in the traditional way, you will recall where we are in the reading of the Torah. You will recall that last Shabbat the Jews left Egypt, right? Mazel tov to them all. And this Shabbat, Pharaoh Paro chases them, traps them at the sea. The great miracle happens, and they sing the song at the sea, Shirat HaYam. And there is a verse in that song which has perplexed and provoked commentators all through the ages, and that verse is Ze Eli V'Anvehu. When the Jews at the sea say, this is my God, Ze Eli. And the word ze is one of those words that it's a word that indicates that you're pointing to something that you're not describing. In analytical philosophy, there is a term for this. It's called ostensive definition, when you want to define something by describing it. So if someone asks you, what is a Volvo? You say, that is a Volvo, without describing what a Volvo is. And the assumption is that we know what it is because we see it. The Midrash agrees that this word ze implies that the Jews on the sea saw something. It was a question of sensory experience. And in one of the ancient Midrashim it says, Ra'ata shifcha al hayam mashalo ra'a Yechezkel ben Buzi, that the humblest maidservant at the sea saw what not even the prophet Ezekiel saw. Now that's the highest compliment that the tradition can pay in terms of knowledge of God, of the Godhead, because you will recall that Ezekiel was the prophet who had the vision of the chariot, who actually saw in a vision the structure of divinity, the chariots and the wheels and the angels and all these things that we commemorate in Kedusha and elsewhere. And Yechezkel is regarded certainly in the mystical tradition as the prophet who had seen and grasped the most about the nature of God. And the Midrash says that the humblest maidservant at the sea saw more than Ezekiel. The problem of seeing God is a problem that recurs throughout our reading of the Bible, but especially of the Torah, and especially of Yetziat Mitzrayim, because it is the classical source for expressions that became known as the problem of anthropomorphism. The problem of anthropomorphism is very simple. In our Bible and in our certainly in our ancient sources, God is frequently described in material and corporeal, in bodily terms. Biyad chazaka v'zro anetuya. He took the Jews out of Egypt with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. Or when he gets angry, it's bechori af, with the fury of his nose. Right? The really striking thing about the Jewish tradition is that nobody, and I'll get to why I emphasize nobody, because there is some scholarly debate about this for a long time now, nobody chose to read those verses literally. As a consequence of those verses, there was created by philosophers, but it's not only a philosophical matter, as I'll say in a moment, the idea that these expressions should be read figuratively and allegorically, not literally, not literally. As I say, this is a technique of interpretation that is most closely associated with Jewish philosophy, with Jewish rationalism. Its first great exponent was Saadia Gaon, who was a giant of a figure in what we would now call Iraq in the 10th century, who really was the first to develop in a systematic way the idea that all material or corporeal descriptions of God must not be read literally. And it is an idea that is climaxed, is most fully developed and practiced in its most sophisticated way by Maimonides, who wrote his great philosophical work, Moreh Nevuchim, The Guide of the Perplexed, essentially as a commentary on scripture. About the perplexed is, one of the perplexities of the person who needs to be guided is the question of these physical descriptions of God, But even in the ancient, but this was not primarily or only a matter for philosophers, and it's very important that you understand that, because when people talk about these things, some people kind of recoil and think, oh well, that's for intellectuals or that's just for philosophy. But there was also Kabbalah and there were other ways. The philosophers refined a view of how to read these verses, of figurative interpretation, that actually runs throughout all the branches of the tradition. So in the ancient sources, for example, we have many cases. The most famous one is Dibra Torah Kilshon Bnei Adam, that the Torah spoke in the language of ordinary people. In other words, the Torah was written in a language that would communicate something to readers so that they would understand it. In order for readers to understand it, these material and bodily descriptions of God were used, but they are not therefore to be taken literally. They are a kind of rhetorical concession to the limitations of ordinary human understanding. But we are not to think that God took the Jews out with a strong hand. Yad Chazakah is simply the best way that the author of the Torah, and I leave it to you to decide who that was, though I'm not sure I trust Rabbi Wolpe on this question, but that the author of the Torah, whoever wrote the Torah, used these expressions as a plausible form of communication. So we have this idea long before Jewish philosophy, and we have it also in Jewish cultures that are deeply anti-philosophical and deeply anti-rational. For example, in the culture of Ashkenaz, which would be the High Middle Ages in France and Germany, which, even though little bits of philosophy kind of, there are traces of philosophy that trickled up from southern France, basically it was an anti-non-philosophical culture. It was a culture of pious people, of law-abiding people, of halachic people, of pietists, of certain kind of mystics. But there were no rationalists, and God knows, not like in Spain, there were no courtiers and warriors and love poetry and gay love poetry and wine songs and so on. It was a very, very, it's what I think of in some way as hardcore Judaism. And there were certain writers, Rashi included, who interpreted these verses to mean that God manifested himself in physical form in order for the Jews to be, I guess, to be shocked and awed. But even these commentators who believed that it was possible for God to manifest himself in physical form, and we know this now because scholars have studied this question recently quite carefully, even these unphilosophical thinkers insisted that the God that appeared in physical form was only God presenting himself, as it were, to us, but that God in himself could not be material, could not be physical. There is only one work that I know of, that scholars know of, in the entirety of the Jewish tradition, an 8th, 9th century mystical work called Shi'ur Koma, which means the measurement of his stature, or the measurement of the stature, which actually describes God as a huge body. And it's a bizarre text. We don't know much about its origins. It has a special place in a certain coarse kind of Kabbalistic current. But it's the only text I know of that accepts this anthropomorphic understanding of God. so that even in the anti-philosophical, anti-rational cultures, everyone understood that these expressions could not be taken literally. And this is a fundamental principle. And by the way, I'm not going to get into it now, but one of the comedies of the recent revival of atheism, including by a late lamented friend of Rabbi Wolpe's and mine, is people, and, but ever since Voltaire, people would make fun of the Old Testament descriptions of God, of his nose and his arm and his hand. And the comedy of this was, of course, that no Jews ever read them that way. Moreover, Jews read them figuratively the way intelligent people read almost everything figuratively. We read poetry figuratively, etc., etc. Literalists are very, very few and far between. And literalism is actually the source of coarse religion, but that's for another morning. I mean, if you want to look for the source of coarse religion, it is the literal reading of scripture. This is true about the question of science and religion, about evolution and religion. Evolution and religion, it is only a problem if you believe that the 7 days of creation meant 7 days. If you believe that they meant 7 days, you have a problem. And the people who read it literally do have a problem and wind up, and we have brothers and sisters in a place called Brooklyn who think the world is 5,772 years old. But the minute you understand that we don't read the Bible figuratively, the question then becomes, what is the scientific truth, etc., etc. But I'm not going that way today. The reason I mention, begin with this anthropomorphic thing is this, that in the Jewish tradition, but not only in the Jewish tradition, it's a human matter. The God that we believe in, we need to be a very, very sublime entity. In other words, it is very hard to believe in a coarse God. That's one of the reasons why we would find it impossible to believe in certain kinds of polytheism, in the gods of ancient Greece, who are basically moody human beings with heavenly powers, right? They're jealous, they're angry, they're competitive, they're nasty, they're silly, and so on. And this is true, by the way, of all the polytheisms, Hindu polytheism. Those gods are basically celestial versions of people, except that they have powers, right? And it must be said that the more one thinks about what one means by the word God, the harder it is to believe in a God who is like us, Or if you want to put it more strongly, those who believe in gods who are like us essentially believe in us. And what they're doing is divinizing and celestializing human beings. But in our tradition, there is a pressure, and a perfectly understandable pressure, to refine and refine and refine and refine our conception of God so as to make God into the most sublime entity we can imagine and understand, and maybe not even imagine and understand. In other words, you get to thinkers like Maimonides who teach that God is so sublime, that we can only say what he is not. And that language is our own, we encounter the limitations of language every time we speak about him. And that God, and in the words of a Christian theologian, if God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived, which seems like a perfectly plausible definition. As I say, we try to make God into the most sublime being that we can. The more sublime God is, the more naturally, as it were, he commands our faith and our allegiance. Okay. The problem with this God is that as we make our concept of God more and more refined and more sublime, we find ourselves backing unwittingly into a troublesome consequence, which is that the more sublime God is, the less plausible it is, the less possible it is to understand what he might have to do with the world and with us, you see. So that the pressure, that on the one hand, we make God finer and more sublime, and on the other hand, by doing so, we remove him more and more and more from the world, and from the world, from all its aspects. So, for example, we remove God from the human world, and there were Christian conceptions of this. For example, there were, for a brief period, there were people known as deists who believed that God created the world and has nothing anymore to do with it. I mean, one of the reasons the United States is one of the great lucky freaks of human history is that we were founded by Christian, bless you, by Christian believers during the 20 minutes in Jewish history when you could be both very religious and believe in a non-interventionist God. If there were Christian deists now, we would have no culture wars. We would have no, but deism disappeared and so on. But a God that is truly sublime becomes less and less of an interventionist God. Because why? What would a God that sublime have to do with our smallest needs or with historical events in this world? Now, there are ways to deal with this question. The people who believe in a sublime God are usually the ones who believe in free will and in natural law, so that basically the account, the cosmological account is that this very sublime God created a world, set it going, according to natural law, and the miracle of creation are not the disruptions of natural law that we think of as miracles, but is actually natural law itself, that nature is the miracle, and that this God also created human beings with free will. So if this world, if we have needs, we have the ability, the capability, both mental and physical, to see to them on our own in some way, to see to them on our own. But that doesn't really solve the problem, because if God is so sublime that he is that in which nothing greater can be conceived, why did he even create the world? This is a huge problem both for philosophers and Kabbalists. If God is this perfectly self-sufficient entity to whom no need can be imputed, because neediness, most rationalists, but not just rationalists, agree, neediness is a concept that is unbecoming of our idea of God, neediness being a quintessentially human and mortal, neediness being a kind of frailty, right? Neediness being a kind of frailty. If neediness cannot be imputed to God, why did God create the world? And so one answer that is given in various sources is out of love. But does it in any way compromise the sublimity of God to even impute love to God? To even impute love to God. Love, after all, being also including some dimension of neediness, right? We know about that. And also imputing love imputing some prior, some relation. And when you're in relation to another being, and we know this from our own experience, what makes the relationship possible is that whatever the magnitude of the differences, let's say between the two people or the two entities, there must be some kind of likeness also. In other words, it would be very hard for us to fall in love with creatures whom we could not recognize, so that even in the science fiction movies, even in E.T. and all, even in the clone movies, even in Blade Runner, and I'm now referring to very late sources in the tradition, but even in things like that, humans fall in love with the cyborgs, or human loves fall in love with the extraterrestrial, because they recognize human qualities in them. Because they discover shared qualities, and the story is so touching because who would have expected these shared qualities, et cetera, right? And so, so there has to be some likeness, some similarity. But if there is, if likeness and similarity is in some way the premise of love or of engagement, then once again we've compromised the sublimity of our idea of God. Because if God is the radically other, so that we cannot use language to describe God physically, and God is that in which nothing greater can be conceived, then God cannot be like us. Then God, in fact, one of the reasons we look up to God, and I'm speaking coarsely here, is precisely for the extent to which he is not like us. The Jewish tradition is full, the ancient tradition, in trying to explain what God is. The Midrash always says, Mashal lemelech, it's like a king. And the metaphor of kingship is used because in the ancient world, the king was actually, in some cultures, actually a god, not in Jewish culture, but there were divine attributes to kingship, which seemed to lift the king up out of the normal run of human events. But what we mean by God is something more sublime than an immortal king, you see. Or, for example, look at the problem doctrinally, philosophically, that Jews have with Christianity. The Jewish problem with Christianity, most people think it is that we object to the fact that they think Jesus was the Messiah, right? Actually, in my own view, that's not the main problem, because Jewish messianism is a history of false messianism. We're accustomed to false messiahs. Jesus was just the most spectacularly false Jewish messiah who ever lived. But this is a phenomenon The one thing that won't go down for Jews is the idea of the Word made flesh, the idea of the incarnation, the idea that God would take human form, that God would have a son, and that this man called Jesus, who was born in Bethlehem and his family came from Nazareth, actually was God in some sense, and not metaphorically. This is something that doesn't just anthropomorphize God, it makes God into a human being to an extent to which one might even say that it is a retraction of the monotheistic idea. If the monotheistic idea is the discovery in our tradition by Abraham, allegedly, though this is all developed in the Midrash and not in the text of the Torah, if the great monotheistic revolution was the abstract, incorporeal, immaterial God who cannot be seen or heard or touched, etc., then making God into a man, into the body of a man, actually retracts the monotheistic idea and pulls it back to a kind of paganism. Because in the pagan world, people actually did believe in the divinity of certain people, right? Etc., etc. So there is, as I say, the problem you come at is that the more refined our idea of God is, and I hope I've made you understand why it is not only legitimate but necessary and inevitable that we would want to refine our idea of God, that we would not want to believe in a coarse entity, but that only an uncoarse entity, and again, you get into problems of language here and it's hard to describe what one means and so on, but that the more abstract and immaterial and incorporeal the God is, the more such a God would command our attention, but the more such a God is like this, the more remote this God is, the more radically other this God is. If God is completely radically other, is there anything we can understand about this God? Because it may be that also understanding operates by like and like, so that we can only understand things that in some way we can arrive at some commonality with, some intellectual, etc., etc. And so you have this idea, you have this tradition of the sublime God who becomes remote, and the greater God gets, the more God seems to be removed from our affairs, so that at the same time as you're fulfilling your one set of requirements for our notion of the deity, we're actually frustrating the other set of requirements, which is that God has something to do with us, that God has something to do with the world, that God has something to do with nature, that God has something to do with history, etc., etc. This is what I mean by the God of the head. This is what I mean by the God of the head. There is an entirely other side to this problem of how to conceive of God, which is what I mean by the God of the heart. There is in the Jewish tradition everywhere, from the ancient tradition in the medievals, and it climaxes in some way in the Hasidic tradition, the conception of God as not just engaged with the world, but as the Americans would say, deep in our business, let's say. There is this conception of God as being aware of and deeply involved in every single act we do, in its rightness and its wrongness, as worrying for us and succoring us and nurturing us and saving us, not just at the end of time in the climax of history, but in our day-to-day lives, I mean, I myself come from my parents come from a Hasidic background in Poland, in Galicia, I'm proud to say, one of the most intellectually coarse Hasidic schools that ever existed. Wonder workers, and I, was raised on stories of my grandfather, who when he had to have a tooth pulled, would arrange to see the Rebbe after he saw the dentist to make sure that the Rebbe agreed that the dentist was right about the tooth that had to be pulled, right? And there is this idea that this conception of God, people turn to God to make sure that they're pulling the right tooth. And we see this everywhere. We see it certainly in American Christianity, all over the place. I mean, God is everywhere. God is responsible for everything. God told Gingrich to run. God told Bachman to run. It's clear God didn't tell Romney to run. And Obama didn't need God to tell him to run. So there is this idea of this God deeply, deeply immersed in our affairs, responsive to the needs of our heart, caring about our heart, and it's a very beautiful conception of God. It's a very God the Father, right? Not God the King, but God the Father. And in this tradition, God has sons, God has children, we're a family, etc., etc. Now, the problem here is the opposite of the problem that I outlined before. Because insofar as we believe in a God who will answer the needs of our heart, who will actually answer our prayers. In other words, if you look at the Jewish liturgy, if you look at the liturgy for this morning's prayers, and you look at, say, the blessings with which it begins, especially in the very beginning of the prayers, and then in the Amidah, they're very concrete. We expect God to care about our health, our harvest, right? We expect God to make us walk upright and to dress us, right? We bless God for dressing the naked. So, in fact, God cared about the fact that we wear clothes. Well, you know the battery of blessings. And we have this liturgy that is exceptionally concrete about our needs. On Yom Kippur, we have the vidui, we have the litany of sins, which couldn't be more concrete. God cares about that we gossip. God cares about that we race to places we shouldn't go to. God cares about how we treat our teachers and parents, etc., etc. God cares about everything we do. And in a certain view, this degree of divine care is the necessary foundation for our moral life, because we are enjoined to do good and to live a certain way by God. If you look in Vayikra, right in the Chumash, there are many, many commandments, many of the ethical ones, especially that there is an injunction, do this, do that, do this, do that, Ani Hashem, I am your God. And the implication there is that the foundation of the various ethical aspects of our relations to other people is that God, nothing less than God cares about this. Widows, orphans, never mind the ritual dimension. I mean, you know, the Kabbalists believed that every single detail of the sacrifice sacrifices at the temple had an effect upon the cosmos. And that's why all those incredibly colorful details, that some of which always wind up in a Monty Python movie, right? all those unbelievable details of them. I mean, Maimonides thought that this is nonsense. The reason that there were sacrifices because the Jews were slaves out of Egypt. And in Egypt, the definition of religion was incoherent without some concept of sacrifice. So if you would have given at Sinai a religion to these people without sacrifices, they couldn't have recognized it as a religion. So what Moses or God and Moses did in his wisdom was to give them sacrifices, but changed with a shinui, some alteration that would make them Jewish or that would make them a more refined sort of sacrifice. So it's hard for me to understand what a refined sacrifice would look like, but that's another matter. But the Kabbalists believed, in fact, that God cares about the sprinkling of the blood on this corner of the altar and the sprinkling of the blood on that corner of the altar. And when Aaron has to take the blood and touch this lobe and that lobe, that actually these have cosmic effects. These have cosmic effects. Now, it sounds ludicrous, but it is another expression of this idea that there is no detail of human life that God does not concern himself with. So this, as I say, is the God of the heart. The problem with the God of the heart is the flip side of the problem with the God of the head, which is that the more we make God emotionally satisfying to ourselves, the more we coarsen our idea of God, and the less easy it may be for such a God to command our assent. In other words, by making God more responsive, by making God more involved, more engaged, more immersed in the details of the world, the natural world. So, you know, if there is this view that if a leaf falls, this is the radical view, that if a leaf falls from a tree, God actually wills every movement of that beautiful leaf until it hits the ground and it lands in the spot where God wanted it to land. I mean, the complete refutation of any idea of natural law. I mean, you don't have to be that extreme, but if there's an earthquake or a tsunami, God wanted it, etc., etc. You can't explain it by natural forces, etc., etc. So the more you immerse God in our experience of nature and of history and of ethics and so on, the more you coarsen God in some way. The more you coarsen God. And this is the other problem, the more responsible you make God for the things that we don't like. for the things that we don't like. The problem of evil, the one that we all struggle with, the book of Job, is premised on the idea that if a man experiences misfortunes, it must be because God cared enough about that man to relate to him in this unfortunate manner. That God judged the man for something, even though we can't see for what, and that every punishment that is visited upon the individual is a punishment that God chooses to visit upon the individual. This, if you really take it far, which we do, can lead you to some very troubling and unattractive conclusions. It's a view of the cosmos, of the moralized cosmos, that's very, very hard to live with. It's very hard to live with. So if you begin with the God of the heart, and if you actually choose to believe in a God who fulfills our needs, who satisfies us, who looks after us, who takes care of us, who provides for us, and so on, or chooses not to provide for us, but also because he's got a position, he's taken a view about us, etc., etc., you arrive at an idea of a God that is changeable, right? Which is why in the Bible, and in the rabbinical tradition, God sometimes gets very moody. God gets angry, God gets pleased, God gets displeased, and so on. This kind of changeability, this mutability, which is characteristic of human beings, right, gets you into this place where, in fact, the God of the heart turns out to be a more humane God, let's say, but for that reason also a more human God. And the question then becomes, can we believe in a human God? Can we believe in a human God? And we're going to talk about this in a minute. What I want to leave you with is this problem, which is, if you want the God of the head, you can have the God of the head, except you can't have him because he's so remote and so distant that then you have to begin to figure out ways to believe that this God actually engages in the world in a way that is meaningful to us in terms of our everyday lives, not just in terms of vast historical outcomes, right? If you want the God of the heart, the God of the heart is in the Jewish tradition too, but then you have the problem of believing in a God who is so much like us, and who is so engaged in the world that in some way you may have compromised his divinity. I don't know, there's no answer to this. I mean, there are these two conceptions, if you will, there are these two traditions. In our tradition, it is certainly true that those who choose the God of the head go to great lengths to find how it is that the God of the head, the sublime God, can actually be connected to us, including Maimonides, including the most radical rationalists. None of the Jewish thinkers who believe in this sublime God believe that God therefore has nothing to do with the world. Nothing. As I say, they believe that it's natural law, they believe that it's free will. You may recall in Pirkei Avot, there's this very strange Mishnah that lists the 10 miracles that were created before the creation of the world. Created the Sinai, the Dead Sea, and so on, the water out of the rock. And it's quite clear that the reason for that Mishnah is because they are these are disruptions of nature that the tradition, as it were, grandfathers into our belief of natural law. So you are somehow so as not to allow miracle to weaken our understanding of natural law. But if you believe in the God, so there is this tradition of the God of the head, and these people are always struggling to figure out how to reconnect God to the world, to history, to nature. And then we have the tradition of the God of the heart, very beautiful, as I say. It climaxes in the Hasidic tradition. But then you get the problem of who is this God? I'll conclude, there's a sentence in an essay written by a great German Jewish philosopher who unfortunately was sort of run out of town by Buber and Rosenzweig and Scholem, a philosopher called Hermann Cohen, who was a remarkable thinker, wrote one of the great masterpieces of modern Judaism. And in one of his Jewish essays, he has a sentence that I've always pondered. He says, "The God of my heart is the God of my mind." That's the sentence. Now, you say absolutely, but the problem with that sentence is that it can be read two ways. Is he saying that the God of his heart, that his mind actually subordinates itself to his heart, so that the God that he believes in with his mind is in fact the God of his heart? Or is he making a statement about his heart and saying that he has subordinated his heart to his mind so that the God of his mind, and he was one of the supreme rationalists in Jewish intellectual history, so that the God of his mind is also, in fact, the God of his heart? Is he trying to say that he believes in the sublime God so much that he actually has feelings and loves this sublime God? That would be the second reading. Or is he saying that the reality of the unsublime God is so obvious to him, the God of love, the God who cares, the God who provides, that even that God is the God of his rational mind? And I have pondered this sentence. I mean, I love this sentence because there is no way to know. There is no way to know. It goes both ways all the time. And that, I think, and that's sort of the problem, if you will, that I want to leave you with, et cetera, et cetera. So now, thank you. We can talk about you. If you have questions. You don't have any water, do you?
No, we have no water.
You have no water.
But we have warm water.
Do you have a rock that you can hit?
Yeah.
Yes.
What are you saying?
Yes, right.
All right, so let me start with one question, and then we'll open it up, because actually of what you said about there's the metaphor of kingship and there's the metaphor of fatherhood. And the day on which God is most king-like is Yom Kippur, although God judges us, so it was also involved. But it's interesting that the priority is given to fatherhood, because it's Avinu Malkeinu, opposed to Malkeinu Avinu.
Mm-hmm.
So does that argue for... Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just know it's warm, so you shouldn't...
It's boiling, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, it's boiling, exactly. So you can only get cold water
sweet.
In the East.
Yeah, I was gonna,
So I wonder if you think that ultimately, if you have to come down on one side or the other, that the Jewish tradition prefers the emotive to the intellectual.
I don't know how to answer that. I think what I tried to say is that the Jewish tradition has both. I think that it is impossible for people to live with a God who is not responsive to them,
right.
Except for certain kinds of mystics, certain kinds of philosophers. But our tradition is not made just for intellectuals. And I don't want you to think, that when I speak about the God of the head, I don't want you to go with thinking it's some elite conception. It's not an elite conception. It runs through the tradition at all levels. As I said, it's not just for philosophers, even though philosophers refined it. Avinu Malkeinu puts them both together, you're right, and indicates that, they're both there. I mean, in the liturgy of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, there are passages in the liturgy that refer only to kingship. HaMelech HaMishpat.
Right, all the Malchuyot.
Right,
verses.
All the Malchuyot, right. But HaMelech HaMishpat, which means the king, the judge, which is a very severe idea of kingship. Oh, thank you.
That should be more to your liking.
Thank you, thank you. Well, now I have a choice. Thank
right.
you.
Free will.
Yes. Yes, right. The God of the head, the God of the heart. My cold water is my hot water. My hot water is my cold water.
Come next time, we'll get you sparkling water.
Thank you. Yeah, then you'll give me Sprite. That will
yes,
be reform. Yes, that will be reform. Yes. So I don't know. I think it's all in there. I do think, however, that even though, the thing about the Jewish tradition is that just about everything is in it.
Yeah.
In other words, I mean, certainly that's true of the classical sources of the Talmud. I mean, there are some things, there are very few things that are not in it. I've never been able to find anything like the Buddhist attitude in the Jewish tradition. I mean, there are certain things but basically everything's in it. And what you do is every soul, since like any great religious tradition, Judaism can accommodate all the souls, all the types of souls, so that people find their ways, and that's why there are many currents of Judaism. There's philosophical Judaism, there's ritual Judaism, there's Kabbalistic Judaism, and so on. I don't think one can answer the question, but I do think one has to face up to the conceptual problems. That's what I think is important.
Yeah.
What is the difference the way significant Hasidic rabbis versus significant Reformed conservative rabbis interpret the Holocaust?
Oh.
just Hasidic.
It's not just Hasidic, ultra-Orthodox rabbis, I would say.
Satma, though, particularly.
Yeah, and even more recently, I mean, I was given some hateful little pamphlets about this from that came out of the ultra-Orthodox communities. Well, I'd have to say this. Unlike Reform rabbis, unlike anyone except the ultra-Orthodox, I'd say first the ultra-Orthodox interpret the Holocaust with confidence. That's the first thing I would say, which is something that very few of us have in approaching the subject. I mean intellectual confidence. Secondly, they interpret the Holocaust the way they interpreted all Jewish adversity, which is punitively. Mm-hmm. We sinned and we were punished. It really is as simple as that. By the way, this sounds offensive, but it has a long roots in our tradition. It is consistent with one very powerful and maybe with the main current of the interpretation of not just the Holocaust but of adversity and even personal misery in our tradition. So it's not some radical departure. It offends our modern sensibilities for various reasons, but it's not some radical departure. From the standpoint of the ultra-Orthodox, or the Haredim, most of the Jewish community of Europe had indeed sinned. I mean, religious reform, the abandonment of traditional halachic life, the rejection of the traditional rabbinical establishment, secularism, political ideologies, Zionism, socialism, Yiddishism, territorialism, you know, Yom Kippur balls, etc. I mean, if from the standpoint of a Haredi rabbi, it looked like the community deserved to be punished. Now, again, we find this grotesque. The other thing I'd say is there is one element of its grotesqueness that actually has no basis in the Jewish tradition, and that the ultra-Orthodox thinkers that I've read on this, and I generally stay away from this literature because it's deeply unpleasant, is the one thing that there is no basis for in the tradition is the punitive understanding of the suffering and death of children. There is nothing in the tradition. In fact, quite the contrary. The death of children represents a spectacular problem in the understanding of evil in the world and in the understanding of God's relationship to evil. And those people who regard the Holocaust punitively, they have a lot to answer for. They have a lot to answer for in that way. The rest of us, not just Reform Jews, as I say, can't approach the problem with any confidence. I will say that I don't believe in the idea of the uniqueness of the Holocaust. I think when we say the Holocaust was unique, that was an expression of emotion about our shock at the magnitude of what had just happened. The attempt to physically eliminate a Jewry was not unprecedented. The Holocaust was only the largest, most sophisticated, and most spectacularly successful attempt to physically eliminate Jews. But, you know, so this expression, the uniqueness of the Holocaust, to me is really an emotional statement. And again, we even have a precedent for this before. The first, with the exception of an episode in 7th century Spain, about which we know very little, the first traumatic attempt in Jewish history to physically exterminate a Jewry was the First Crusade, was the persecutions of the Jews in the First Crusade. When you read the chronicles, the Hebrew chronicles of the First Crusade, you discover that the way in which that generation explained its misfortune to itself, the survivors, and they had a big problem because they knew that the First Crusade actually destroyed what even they knew was one of the most pious and pure Jewries that ever existed. I mean, this was the Jewry of Rashi and the Tosafists. These were the people who invented the study of the Talmud in some deep way. These were people who rejected rationalism and who developed a pietistic mysticism. And so they had to explain this because they actually, and you could say it's arrogant, but there was a basis in reality for that. You know, it was almost as if you want to destroy the Jewish philosophers, fine, but why us? And their explanation was twofold. One, they said it was Dor Echad, that they were a special generation. They were unique. And so God loved them and tested them in some way. But the assumption about the uniqueness was that it couldn't happen again. And in the chronicle of the Second Crusade, there is a heartbreaking passage right at the beginning of the chronicle. There appears in France a virulently anti-Semitic preacher, a Cistercian monk named Radolf, who preaches the death to the Jews again. And the Jews, and this is 1146, so it's 50 years after the First Crusade. And the Jews in France send letters to the Jews of Germany telling them, fast and give charity and pray because it's coming again. And they get back a letter, and the only sentence we have from this letter is, it's an inversion in its meaning, but it is a verse from the prophet Nahum, and it's Pa'amayim lo takum tzara, that misfortune cannot happen twice. That was the last time a Jew ever thought that. That was the last time a Jew ever, that sentence is one of the most chilling sentences I've ever read in Jewish literature. So as I say, the Holocaust was not unique. It's perfectly acceptable to begin to struggle to wrestle with it in that way.
Nathan? Next.
That's an important point.
Could you sort of summarize that for me?
Oh, I think the comment is that we know from the scientific study of nature, which requires advanced mathematics, that this, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that this takes us, it takes us into its own realms of incomprehensibility, and secondly, that given all the difficulties we have in understanding abstractly the truth about the physical world, it seems hard to imagine that we could arrive at such an understanding of metaphysics. Is that
because we have a language? Math is a language that we use for these abstract truths, but we have no equivalent. But the Kabbalists actually tried that.
This is it. I mean, I think two things. I think in the first place, the Jewish philosophers all agreed that whatever the metaphysical truth is, it has to be compatible with the scientific truth. In other words, if you read Maimonides, there are large parts of Maimonides that look obsolete because he's operating with the Ptolemaic world picture, or with the Aristotelian idea of the universe as the spheres, which we now know is simply false, the history of science being a history of mistakes, right? But if you get behind that, the deeper principle in Maimonides is that your metaphysical ideas must be consistent with and in some way grow out of your understanding of physical reality. In other words, so that the implication from Maimonides and of philosophers like him is even if the particular science that they were operating with we now know to be erroneous, because in fact everybody writes in their own time, right? And 200 years from now, the scientists who are deriving metaphysical conclusions from string theory, it may look like they were operating with a false picture too, even though they're doing the best they can. The principle involved is that in some way there must be some relationship between, and in the case of Maimonides, in the long intellectual march to metaphysical truth, you have to pass through physics. You have to pass through physics. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that that doesn't mean that the language of metaphysics should be derived from the language of physics. Quite the contrary. You can make the argument that, well, the reason it's called metaphysics is not just because that was the book that Aristotle wrote after he wrote the physics. It doesn't just mean after book one. It actually means something else, something beyond. And the history of metaphysical thought, of philosophy, in philosophy and in religion, has consisted in the attempts to devise various vocabularies that could deal with metaphysical problems. Now, some of these vocabularies were, as David mentioned, were Kabbalistic. You could say that in that sense, they were more the product of the religious imagination than of the religious intellect, because the Kabbalistic concept for the description of metaphysical realities were not argued for. They were imagined, or a plenitude of occult entities were imagined, and then in what looks like rigorous ways, they were connected to them, each other and themselves. And as you can see, I'm not deeply sympathetic to Kabbalah, but I'm trying to give as objective a picture as I can of what they did. And then there were philosophers who tried to use logic and rational argument to justify certain metaphysical concepts, and other philosophers would come along and refute them. The most notorious example being the way in which, let's say, Maimonides insisted that the metaphysical truths were to be found in nature, because that was what God created. If you're looking for the miracle of creation, look at nature. And Spinoza reads this and decides, actually, there's one more step to be taken, which is not that God may be found in nature, but that God is nature. That God is nature. But this is the history of metaphysics. You could argue that there is no metaphysical vocabulary that we can use with the confidence with which we use scientific vocabularies. But against that, I would argue, as I said, that the history of science is in fact the history of mistakes, and that many, many world pictures, scientific world pictures, which were incredibly useful for religion and philosophy, which provided enormous inspiration, not just poetic inspiration, though they did that too, but also intellectual inspiration, many of them were also false. So in some way, I have less confidence in science having the last word, in the way that philosophers make this distinction between believing in and believing that, right? We believe in a certain scientific theory, but if you ask a scientist who believes in a certain scientific theory, does he believe that the universe is really that? He would have to see, the honest ones would say, well, I can't say that. I can just say this is what I think it is, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a long answer. I'm sorry.
All right. We're actually out of time. So let's do this very
fast.
Let's
do
one,
two more quick
questions.
Three
quick questions.
Yes.
Ask all three questions and then.
Oh,
I'll
no. Let's do one at a time because
I. Sure?
Yeah.
All right. Then you got to be.
I'll be quick.
Okay.
Oh, the pronoun problem is a huge problem. As far as I'm concerned, if you'd like to use she, you can use she, you can use it. No, but look, if you think about it, if we're talking about the God of the head, and we agree that language is essentially limited, essentially metaphorical, essentially allegorical, it does not refer, it is not descriptive, then she to me is no less offensive than he. And he is offensive not on feminist grounds only, but on philosophical grounds. On philosophical grounds. The point is, and Maimonides recognized this, we need to use language. We need to use language. We are self-interpreting beings who express ourselves in language, right? And our concepts, we give them form in words. So one option would be just to fall silent. One option would be just to fall silent. There's a wonderful story in an ancient Greek philosopher, Diogenes. You will recall Heraclitus once said that you cannot step in the same river once, by which he wanted to give a sense of the flux of things. I mean, he said,
twice.
I'm sorry, you cannot
twice.
Step in the same river twice.
Twice.
Along came another philosopher who said, Heraclitus' concept is too flabby. You cannot step in the same river once. And a philosopher next to him wanted to show that this man's concept of flux was too flabby, and the only way he could do it was to raise his finger and do this. Because language itself would freeze and reify things. So I would say, for this school of thought, it doesn't matter. We have to use language. The important thing is to use language in full awareness of its limitations. In full awareness of its... But we do this, by the way, with people we love all the time. In other words, the metaphorical use of language is not at all uncommon or offensive for things that are really important.
Okay. When you look at the God of the head,
yeah.
There's one dimension of time.
Of time, yeah.
Time. Uh-huh.
Well, yes.
Maybe we are the anchor for this world, for the present. Because when you look at God's word, which is day by day, has day by day, which means present. And then, so I don't know what's your philosophy on the
That's a huge question. The question of the you've put your finger on a very important point, which is the centrality of the present to Jewish belief and to Jewish life generally. That's a subject for a very long conversation. I will say only that don't be quite as sure that God has a past, a present, and a future, because those who believe in the God of the head would say that temporality is exactly what cannot be imputed to God, because temporality, we measure temporality by change. Right, that's how we know about time.
That's why there's no time in LA.
There you go. All right. Yes, there you go.
You're timeless here.
Thank you for raising the conversation conceptually. But imputing temporality to God is like imputing corporeality to God. Once you go down the road of the sublime God, as I say, you never find anything you can say, etc.
Bob,
you forgive the shameless plug, but we've been talking about Healer of Shattered Hearts earlier, which is 22 years old now.
I forgive you, yes.
And it seems like the whole book was a response to the God of the head that we were raised with, at least in the conservative movement, those rabbis who were influenced by Mordecai Kaplan and the Reconstructionism, and that your book was an attempt to try to bring it back.
It was in the Heschel counter tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right, which is Hasidic in some way.
Try to bring about some
and
kind
Midrashic.
Of mm-hmm. melding of the God of the head and the God of the heart. So who do you feel, or what religious movements do you think are most successful at bringing together the God of the head?
I'll tell you, the answer is, as I say, both the elements are there. People who arrive, like myself, who arrive at an intensely intellectualized or abstract idea of God, in some ways we impoverish our lives. There's no question about it. In some ways we impoverish our lives. On the other hand, I've never believed in the intellectual authority of need. In other words, just because I need something to be true, that has no bearing on the question of whether it is. I've always been deeply skeptical, not about the reality of human needs, but about the place of human need in the understanding of certain questions, right? If I fall in love with a woman, the fact that I need this woman does not mean that my view of her, that my description of her is correct. In fact, if anything, I need to be skeptical, because the more intense my need is, the more incorrect my description might become, because I will be inventing her in the image of my desire. And since I do not wish to live without my desire, and since she is spectacularly attractive to me in various ways, this is who I'm going to insist that she is. Until 3 years later I discover she isn't, and we call a lawyer, right? It's just, right? But we all know about this. In other words, but one thing I want to leave you with is the question of what should be the authority of human need in our understanding of the world, not just of God, but in our understanding of things, of need, of desire, of subjectivity generally. We cannot live without need. We are needy beings, and we want our needs to be fulfilled, but we should not mistake what fulfills our need for the truth. The truth, that's something entirely different, and we have to operate at both levels.